It's easier, someone once said, to imagine the end of the world than it is the end of capitalism.
But it's clear that what we can make systems of this complexity, cultural systems, economic systems, machines of this complexity, surely we could make a world that could first meet those needs I described that everyone should have, and then perhaps meet needs that people have only dreamed of, like the need for some autonomy and freedom. The need for that little space up there, the eye part, to expand a little bit. Just a little.
Just a little.
Just a little.
Socialism that could engage with the yearnings and dreamings and
Miles Davis music.
An aesthetic dimension.
Radically incompatible with everyday life under capitalism. Capitalism.
Hey there, Acid Left listeners. We're here with Brian Francis Culkin, writer, director, and healer. Brian has written 10 books and directed 3 films. We're going to talk today about a book called On Heroin as it relates to addiction and capitalist society. Before going on to speak about Brian's healing center based in Peru, which is called The Way of the 12 Plants, and includes a plant-based diet form of healing. And we'll be talking also about an Acid Left kind of regular topic, that is the link between what we might call spirituality or some kind of self-knowledge and some kind of rejuvenation of the left wing. So to start all that off, I'll be passing to my regular co-host, Adam Ray Adkins. I'm Mike Watson. I hope you enjoy.
Thank you, Mike. And thank you, Brian, for coming on. You know, I read. I've seen your YouTube series, the Fragment series, which I think you've released 7 out of 11 of. And I read your book On Heroin: America, Capitalism, and the Search for Meaning. Seems to me, in both of those, it's like a wonderful expansion on many of the themes written about by Mark Fisher. It's also an influence for a lot of our work. In the book, you put forward this idea that the American opioid epidemic has its roots in the commodification of every aspect of social life, combined with this sensory overload in contemporary life, and compounded with intense individualization and dehumanization. In other words, the neoliberal model of managing society. Even claiming that perhaps America was addicted to the opioid OxyContin before it was even produced. Can you tell us the ways that addiction and capitalism kind of mirror each other and what makes the heroin addict the symbol of the world that we live in?
Certainly one of the symbols. I don't know if we could say that it's the symbol, but I think without question, you know, I think the heroin, and I should say the heroin epidemic was probably more intense about 5 or 6 years ago than it is right now. And I think part of the reason why we're not seeing it as much is because things run in cycles, but also because you have all these other drugs involved now, like fentanyl. And so it's really kind of, I don't really know what's happening right now on the ground in terms of drug culture, but it seemed heroin, seeing it more clearly maybe 10 years ago was easier. Now, as for the relationship between addiction and capitalism, I think this is very interesting. And I think it has to do with the relationship between what I would say quantity and quality, in the sense that for both, you continually need a higher quantity of a substance, whether it's heroin or capital, to produce the same qualitative experience over time, being high on dope or generating profit. You know, like the concept of Marx, the falling rate of profit, which is one of the centerpieces of that theory, and I think it's a very good idea, is that the idea that the rate of profit would tend to decline over time as a result of technological changes or the various efficiency introductions that have been introduced by management. And I think there is something similar with addiction, and we could call it like the rate in which the euphoria declines or something like that. I don't know. But it's like you need more heroin to get the same level of euphoria, you know, and that's like the basic mechanism of building up a tolerance. And I think this is why the behavior of addicts, you know, like the classic trope of stealing money from your mother's pocketbook, is in a way like structurally similar to shutting down a factory in Ohio or Pennsylvania or in Birmingham and moving it to China or Indonesia. So I think there's a structural similarity, and it has to do with the relationship between quantification and quality, or having a qualitative experience, and how to maintain a certain quality requires more, to maintain the same level of quality requires more and more quantity. And this is, I explain this, you know, biologically or scientifically, in the book a little bit, when I talk about the mechanism of how the process of addiction works in terms of heroin, of how when you inject something like heroin into the body, what it does to the nervous system. And there's tremendous similarity when you just look at this from a structural perspective of how global capitalism operates. Would you like me to elaborate more on that?
If you like to, but I mean, I think that is pretty clear. I think it's a really apt comparison. And it kind of drives that there's like this, also this psychological component to our participation within capitalism.
Oh, for sure. For sure. For sure. And I think too, you could probably say that about capitalism in general, but this specific mode of neoliberal late capitalism, the sense of personal motivation that's required, the sense of this kind of all out Darwinian competition with, it's almost like a Hobbesian war of all against all that we're having right now. This, of course, exasperates and alienates the individual in society. And, you know, if people aren't feeling good, they're going to do something to try to make themselves feel better. I think that's natural. And heroin and opiate addiction has become a very popular means of self-medication. And in a way, the way I talk about it in the book, it's almost like a way to heal yourself. Of course, it's a terrible way to do it because it makes things worse. But, you know, the opiate addiction in contemporary American society is very much a search or a desire to feel okay about yourself in a society that is obliterating solidarity, community, individuality. And in my personal opinion, individuality is based on the series of relationships that we have in our life. And if those are all monetized and instrumentalized and kind of colonized by algorithms and the forces of social media, then obviously the subjective experience of the individual is going to become pretty desperate. And I think, you know, when heroin addiction really started in America with the introduction of OxyContin, which came on the market in the late 90s, that eventually morphed into heroin in about 2010, 2011. I mean, this was just at the time when this onslaught, or what I call in the book, the integration of computational power and global capitalism began to become a reality. You know, like heroin addiction, and then, I mean, this is not to say heroin addiction has not been around in America or in history. I mean, there was a whole generation of Civil War soldiers that were addicted to heroin. There was, you know, like the Beat Generation, William Burroughs was doing heroin in Times Square. And you had, of course, different histories of heroin epidemics in disenfranchised African-American communities in the post-war era. But what was interesting about the 21st century heroin explosion is that it kind of like dispersed itself into suburbia. It kind of went everywhere, became kind of gaseous. And that, I think, is representative of this morph of capitalism from its former industrial analog operation to this kind of digital matrix that's everywhere. And heroin became a symbol, or the heroin addict became a symbol of the person who was just unable to cope with the intensities of the flows of digital logic and capital.
Yeah, the heroin addiction, like you said, in 2010, really struck my community pretty hard. I was living in Memphis, Tennessee at the time and running like DIY art venues and whatnot. And you saw a lot of really talented, bright people go down terrible paths through it. And
oh, yeah.
Definitely seems a lot stronger than the heroin addictions of the late 70s and early 80s, which my mom was a part of as well. It's a terrible thing.
I just want to say one thing. The shift from OxyContin to heroin happened around that time because that's when the FDA regulated the OxyContin 80 milligram pills that were so popular from, you know, the late 90s. When the OxyContin epidemic first hit, it was concentrated in Appalachia, down East Maine, and Boston, really, suburban Boston. Those are the three first hotspots that began in like the late 90s, 2001 or so. And then by 2007, 2008, it was like all over the country. And when they regulated the 80 milligram pills, that's when you saw like the shift to heroin. And then it became really bad in like 2011, 2012, 2013. And it's still bad now, but now it's just, it's very, like everything in our world, it's very confusing now of what's happened. It's not as hard, it's much harder to generate a coherent narrative of the drug culture in American society right now than it was even 10 years ago.
Right. Down East Maine is another community that's close to my heart. I did some time with the Beehive Collective in Machias, and I definitely saw the outgrowth of some of that, not through them, but in the general area and like Bangor, Maine and stuff, the outgrowth of some of that opioid addiction really, there.
That's really funny. My cousin was very much involved in the Beehive Collective as well. She lived up in Millbridge for a long time. You probably know.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, we'll talk about that later, maybe. Yeah. You kind of hinted at this. I wanted to talk about two figures that strike me, and they present themselves as kind of these saviors to our malaise that we're in right now. And I would say false saviors, of course. The first being someone that I've only ever known about in passing, but reading about your book, I decided to watch a lot of their videos, and it's that self-help guru Tony Robbins. And in On Heroin, you call him the prophet of neoliberalism. So yes. Could you tell us a little bit about Tony Robbins and why he deserves that title?
Sure. Well, Tony Robbins is the kind of the figurehead of the personal motivation industrial complex, which is, he's kind of the archetypal symbol of it. And I think it does go back further if you look back in time to like, you know, Norman Vincent Peale or Ernest Holmes, these kind of people of thinking positive. And of course, there's nothing wrong with thinking positive and wanting to visualize good things about your life. But I think what's interesting with Tony Robbins is that he comes along at a very specific time in the mid-1990s, just as the shift from a kind of industrial-based economy to a post-industrial digital economy begins to take hold. And when that happens, the individual ceases to be an employee in the traditional sense and starts to become an entrepreneur. And even if you work at a company, like at a 9-to-5 job, you have all these entrepreneurial expectations levied upon you that would be very different from the classic, you know, gray-suited man who used to work in the old model of American capitalism. I always think of Jack Lemmon's character in the film The Apartment, one of my favorite, one of the great Billy Wilder films, of like the classic industrial gray-suited man. And that kind of person doesn't exist anymore. The person that exists today is like, you know, and Lemmon had this 9-to-5 job. He wore like this kind of proper suit and tie every day. And that has been displaced to like, now you have like the coder listening to his iPhones with tattoos in his body. And, you know, it's a totally different environment of how capitalism legitimizes its own symbolic space. And I think someone like Tony Robbins, and there's a lot of Tony Robbins, by the way. I mean, my Facebook, my paid advertisements, it's like every day there's like 50 new people who want to be the next Tony Robbins. So there's a whole ecology. That's why I call it the personal motivation industrial complex, because there's a whole ecology of these people. And it's basically the way I would describe Tony Robbins and his discourse and the whole discourse of that community is to try to get the neoliberal subject, the 21st century individual living within late capitalism, to be able to psychologically tolerate the conditions, really the impossible conditions that are being that he's being constantly interpolated with or constantly made to adhere to. So Robbins, you know, offers these kind of psychological tools and kind of pseudo new age wisdom and platitudes and so on and so forth, and different, you know, tactics and strategies to be able to deal with this kind of technological onslaught. And really what it is, it's a competitive onslaught. And so it's this you internalize this desire to be your best self. You internalize, and again, there's nothing wrong with, I mean, I want to be my best self. I think everyone does. But the difference is that when you try to do that within a hyper-competitive capitalist framework, you don't really become your best self. You become kind of this manic, frantic, kind of psycho in a way, of constant personal productivity and personal optimization in the service of techno-capital. And that to me is so sad, and it's so dangerous too. And you know, one of my favorite contemporary authors is Byung-Chul Han, who's written a series of really, really great books. And I think he says in his book, Psychopolitics, that one of the strange features of this optimized or motivated version of late capitalism, the one that Tony Robbins has, I don't know if he invented it, but his ideas have really permeated society in so many ways, from professional sports, the Fortune 500 corporations, and virtually everything. It's this idea that the boss and the employee become fused into the individual. In other words, like 50 years ago, the boss would tell you, hey, you're not working hard enough, Smith, do a better job. Whereas now we do it to ourselves. We're constantly attacking ourselves for not doing enough, for not working hard enough, for not being productive enough. I mean, this kind of attitude would be totally foreign to our grandparents. I mean, totally. I was talking with Mike earlier about how my grandmother's from Liverpool. I mean, I couldn't even imagine her thinking that. I mean, it would just be totally, totally foreign to her viewpoint of life. And, but it's totally natural to us. And it's really natural to people who are young, like 16. I mean, people are becoming computational. I don't even know how to describe it, but they're becoming so instrumental in their outlook that everything is being reduced to clicks, likes, the generation of profit, data, so on and so forth. And this is very, very problematic and very scary. And so that's what I'd say about that, Tony Robbins. Again, I mean, I don't know if Tony Robbins is a bad guy. I mean, I don't even know if he's conscious of what he's even doing or what he's saying. What I think Tony Robbins is, what he signifies is this dissemination of a certain kind of ideology that has become kind of the maiden to 21st century global capitalism, which is personal productivity always, which is the instrumentality of human life itself, which is the commodification of everyday wisdom and everyday friendship. And, you know, like Tony Robbins says, like, sells seminars on like how to fall in love. I mean, this is, from a certain perspective, that is like, I mean, human beings from like 100 years ago would find that so unbelievably obscene. But we, as 21st century people, were like, oh yeah, cool, I'll pay for that. And actually, Alan Badiou's book, In Praise of Love, talks about this, and it's so poetic what he says in his critique of that. But so that's how I think Tony Robbins figures into that. And then if you live in a society under the Tony Robbins rhythm, when you wake up in the morning and you like feel the need to be productive, and if you don't do it, you feel bad about yourself and that you're not good enough, then you get into depression, you get into anxiety, and maybe even you get into drug addiction. So that's the link between Robbins and heroin addiction, in the sense that, you know, you fall into heroin addiction. Of course, there are a lot of mitigating factors, trauma, family dynamics. You know, I don't want to reduce something as complicated as heroin addiction to a single thing. But the point I make in the book is that if you live in a society that's constantly making you be, that's essentially turning you into a productive machine of and an ideological robot, you might very well become a heroin addict, because that experience is so painful. It's so alienating. It's so isolating. It's so disrespectful to the world and to family and to community. You very well might turn to heroin addiction as a means to cope.
Yeah. You know, I think you have a unique and spot on interpretation of Robbins. Like I said, I was only vaguely familiar with him as a self-help person, and I ended up watching hours of YouTube videos, clips, old clips, new clips, his own promotional material, people critiquing him, and I'm not afraid to say it. I think he is a bit of a psychopath. But I will have to say, I did do his morning speech routine this morning of meditating, sitting in good posture, vocal exercises, jumping in a cold shower. I personally don't have a 57 degree pool specifically in my backyard for that, but so I had to take a cold shower, and I feel pretty great.
No one's going to deny that these guys have some good ideas, and that's not what I.
Right.
I mean, my point was not like he's some horrible guy and you shouldn't listen to him. My point was like, be your best self, take a cold shower, meditate in the morning. I mean, these are all good things. I mean, who would want to deny that to somebody? When you sing Tony Robbins, these on the surface beneficial maxims of how to live a good life, and you place that within the confines of the, I don't even know what to say, like the global capitalist apparatus, the technological system that we're living in, it's going to be problematic because you can't live a good life in that system. You can't live a really, truly good life in that system. So you get confused, and then you get all kinds of psychopathologies and emotional dysfunctions, and really it's a spiritual malady. It's a socialized spiritual malady of narcissism, of selfishness, of thinking that your own productivity is the end all be all of human existence.
Right, right. And in one of his promotional things where he's a big proponent of network marketing or multi-level marketing, pyramid schemes. And one of the things I saw where he was talking about the virtues of that, he basically said that biologically only certain people are cut out to be successful businessmen. But luckily, nowadays, you can be, you know, a franchise network marketer, and that way you can enjoy the success of a successful businessman without taking on the full responsibility that you're, you know, beta mind can't handle or something. And I was like, this is dangerous shit. Like, there is some really scary underlying thoughts there.
Yeah, I mean, Zizek would say about that, pure ideology. I mean, that's, you can almost see a meme of his face saying pure ideology. And yeah, I mean, that of course has to do with the dehierarchization of capitalism and kind of making it, you know, that's like Mark Fisher's idea of capitalist realism. It's everywhere. It's no longer just the company boss. It's now extended itself horizontally through society, where everyone's directly participating in the rhythm of capitalism. So yeah, it's super dangerous, and it's also stupid, and it also doesn't really work as a practical matter. But I think he's probably right that, I mean, in terms of just, I don't think everyone is cut out to be a businessman. You know what I mean? So I think he's probably right to a point about that. But I think by trying to ideologically mask it through networks probably does a tremendous amount of damage to society. And it also takes away from like actual productive work that people could be doing. I mean, one of the things in America that's so crazy is that there's such a lack of like labor, like people who can do shit, like, you know, carpenters and plumbers and stuff like that. I mean, because people get involved in these network scams and, you know, wanting to, whatever they want to do, they're caught up in the ideology of Tony Robbins, basically of neoliberal hyper competitive capitalism. And then you look at like the plumber is like some loser who can't do anything, you know what I mean? And it's like the exact opposite. I mean, people who have skilled trades now, I mean, these guys are, they have a 9-to-5 job, they're, you know, they can work, and of course the situation is not ideal for them either, but it's certainly better than being some, you know, freelancing entrepreneur who's listening to Tony Robbins tapes, that's for sure.
Okay, so some great points there. I'm just coming in, if I can. I'm just reflecting on this idea of like, I guess, competition or the pressure one puts on oneself even to be well. So like the well-being industry or this kind of like version of it, which is kind of, I guess, machoistic. It's kind of really kind of putting pressure on, you know, on people to like to feel their best, to be their best, and that's actually kind of counterproductive, as you were both saying. So I'm just thinking about, you know, Logic Brothers, Logic Bros, Sam Harris, Ben Shapiro, etc., and this kind of like, you know, this kind of thing of like being a kind of lean logic machine, and the pressure there is to kind of to be like that,
sure,
for people on YouTube, also in kind of generally in social media.
Yes.
And then the less response coming from people like Ben Burgess, but you know, there's many people, and the kind of the pressure now on the left to be like that, or if not like that, just to be very good Marxists. One is a Marxist, or it could be an anarchist or whatever, but the way we end up kind of enacting, and the way we end up almost putting on costumes on, sure, you know, in social media, so that you're spending more time declaring your Marxism than you are really thinking of kind of
how to help people,
reasonable solution. So I'm kind of really seeing that as a reflection, and that kind of like tying the left in to what it's trying to oppose, which is kind of very much in line with some kind of modernist discussions and the way that the capitalism commodifies everything. So even the opposition becomes commodified. So punk rock, Nirvana, Kurt Cobain, to use a Marxist example. So just basically that, I'm going to throw that out there and see if you could see that.
Yeah, what you just said really reminded me of Adam Curtis's film, The Trap, which is one of my, I'm sure you know Curtis, he's a great BBC documentarian.
Yeah,
and
sure.
His film, The Trap, part two of it specifically, it deals with this instrumentality that started to become part of the British state apparatus in the 1990s with New Labour. And he basically talks about how the welfare state that had been built up following the Second World War, when it began to be dismantled, it was dismantled to adhere to this like statistical these like hyper statistical analysis and personal productivity. So it was this combination of like Tony Robbins' logic on one hand and this kind of mathematical instrumentality on the other, fusing into one. And what gets lost in this are like British communities and like single mothers and like poor people. And like, so it's like they wanted to make the state apparatus or the social welfare state more efficient. But what they did is they made it inhumane and they made it no longer really able to actually help human beings. So what you were saying there perfectly reminded me of Curtis's really, really profound insights in that film. And I think that, yeah, I mean, I don't get into that stuff at all. Like one of my favorite writers of all time is G.K. Chesterton. And Chesterton's kind of, just kind of joyous, I don't know how to describe his attitude. It's not even lowering yourself to getting involved in those kind of debates of who's the best communist or who's the best Christian or who's the best anarchist. It's having common sense and having a real philosophical mind. And I think when you get into those technical arguments, you tend to lose the big picture. So I try to be more of a big picture person. And then of course, in your regular life, you try to be a good person and do what you have to do to help people. But I see that all the time. I always think of these people as like people who believe in science or something like this. You know, there's all these people on, and they try to like prove their chops by expressing their scientific literacy and putting down any kind of either traditional religious position or certainly New Age position. And and the other thing too, especially since COVID, is this kind of attack on conspiracy theories. And of course, conspiracy theories usually are pretty stupid, but we're coming to the point that even like a critic, like a legitimate critical reflection is a conspiracy theory. I mean, if like Kierkegaard or Nietzsche were alive today, they'd be conspiracy theorists, I think, based upon this new hyper-rational discourse, whether it be at the left or the right. So I think a good position or a good outlook or an interesting line of thought definitely has to be separated from those kind of hyper-instrumental arguments and technical deliberations about certain ideologies. I mean, those don't free people. You know, you want to free yourself from these kind of constraints. And this isn't to say you can't be a rational thinker or have technical points in your thought, but it's having a balance. I think that's the main thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty hard to escape though when it's like, it's our form of communication. It's our form of feeling together with other people. So
yeah, I mean,
if you're not,
I think
taking part, then you don't really feel to yourself as a valid subject. Then if you're
and
taking
the paradox
part,
of that is, and the paradox of that is like that discourse is inherently alienating and isolating. It doesn't like join people together. I guess maybe because I've been living in the Amazon jungle for the past 4 years, and like the day-to-day life and the day-to-day rhythm of certainly out in the jungle communities. And then where I live, I kind of live halfway between. I have a place right in the downtown Iquitos, and also I have a property out in the jungle where my center is. And it's just not like that down there. Like people, jungle people are by no means neoliberal subjects. You still have this real kind of gesture of humanity that's still there. So you don't get into these kind of weird technical, it's not part of the culture down there. So I think for me, I'm kind of grateful because my day-to-day life is not immersed in that kind of environment. I definitely see it on social media and stuff like that. And I just tend to not even get involved with it really. You know, I just don't even bother to engage with that kind of stuff.
But that to me will take some kind of feat of character in itself that I guess needs some training of the mind, because it's like, you know, you're a writer, so you want people to read your books. So how do you know they're reading your books if you're not engaged in social media to see if people are reading your book? You know what I mean? It's like you want to get your stuff out there. So no, I'm saying you're not doing that, or you're not aware of how people are receiving your books. But we're kind of pretty much tied into this thing. And to turn around and go like, well, I don't really, you know, I'm not.
No, I didn't mean.
It's quite difficult.
Well, I mean, I don't have Twitter or anything like that, but I mean, I have a small YouTube channel I just set up, and starting to make videos, and I make Facebook posts all the time, but I make them on my terms and write what I feel or think or my own analysis. I mean, we're friends on Facebook, so you may have seen some of my stuff.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thing, actually. You're one of the few people actually making lengthy observations, you know, kind of like, I suppose, like fragments from the Frankfurt School, a bit like, you know, one section or one, we say paragraph
it's like
chapter of Minima Moralia or something. A Benjaminian fragment, whereas everyone else is just posting a meme or a very pithy kind of comment. So that in itself is interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so when I do that, like when I say I don't engage, I don't mean like I don't go on social media. What I mean is that if I see these pithy arguments happening on someone else's, I don't comment or get involved with that kind of stuff. You know, I just make my posts, and I don't even really respond to any of the comments because I'm not really interested in, I don't want to sound like a jerk, but I mean, I'm not really interested in getting into arguments on social media. I mean, I've been attacked many times, and it's just not that fun. So I just, you know, make my comment. If people like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. I mean, I don't really care. It's just, you know, I tend to be writing something, like I'm working on a book or working on something like that. And then I have an idea, I'll write this on Facebook, and that's it. You know, I don't even really pay attention to what happens afterwards. It's just my perspective on something that's happening. And actually, one of my books is called Spontaneous Reflections, Volume 1. And it's basically a collection of all these kind of micro essays that I've written on Facebook. So I think it's a cool form. And I do think that it is possible to have really cool, productive conversations on social media, as problematic as social media is and what these technologies have done to communal and social life across the planet. Of course it's possible to have I met you guys from social media, so it's total, and I think what you guys are doing is totally cool. But in terms of what you're talking about, these like I believe in science type of things, like I just don't get involved with that because that's not really what interests me, even though I do respect science and believe in science.
Sure. I mean, just to add something before I can let Adam come back in, because I know he has something prepared he wants to ask. But yeah, I mean, the tech is really useful, obviously. And if you think about the kind of critiques made of media culture in the middle of the last century, that it wasn't that, you know, it was all top down, that it wasn't interactive enough, then that's obviously not the case. It is interactive now. To a much greater degree, that, you know, we can make our own media, we can make our own statements and have our own audiences. But somehow we're still being led down a wrong path. But it's still there to be used as we wish. And that's something we forget, that you know, it's very much about our attitudes. So I very much agree that there is some way of reconfiguring our relationship with online media and tech. And I think, Adam, you could come back in because you're going to mention Elon Musk. No?
Yeah, that's. I think that fits right in line with what I wanted to ask. And it's the other person I see as a big false savior of our time. Elon Musk. And I think it relates directly to this sensory and information overload you talk about in On Heroin. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that constant feed of information, what it does to our bodies, our thoughts, our psyche, and specifically Elon Musk's Neuralink, which he seems to be proposing as a partial solution for this, which is the plan to directly hook the human brain to the computer or the internet.
So that's a big question. First, in terms of just the general structure of digital technologies and the global network, I would use the thinking of René Girard, the French anthropologist, and his work on the concept of mimetic desire. I think that the linkage of the entire cerebral or neurological surface of the human race through these technologies is causing us to mimic each other more and more, and it's drawing our brains closer and closer together. And that, of course, is fueling the frustration, anger, this kind of buildup of surplus desire. And that's why you have these like Twitter lynch mobs and, you know, people getting, this kind of cultural unmasking, this kind of cyberbullying and digital harassment that's happening. It's so sad. It's happening all the time. And it's super painful too. And so I think that's part of it, is like, where like our subjectivity as individuals, it's being drawn too close to the other through this, like I said, this integration of computational power and capitalism. We're becoming too close and we're not able to differentiate ourselves, and that's causing subjective destitution, and also it's causing violence. And you know, right now it's being contained online to a point, but as we see in America, it's starting to spill out into the streets. I mean, I think part of the as bad as something like Twitter is, I mean, really bad. I mean, I view that site as so problematic. But I mean, in a way, what Twitter does is it keeps the violence inherent to human community. It keeps it online. And I think that was maybe the, I don't know, like the quote unquote unconscious function of these technologies to a point. But I think now what's happening is that it's not like it's going to start to spill over. And it's going to hit the streets at some point. And I think we're starting to see that in America right now. And that's very dangerous. And I think Elon Musk is trying to like take it the next step up to keep that that mimetic violence that Girard would talk about, to keep it not only online, but now have it actually integrated into our own neurological topology. So I think something like Neuralink, man, it's pretty scary stuff. And it's also like, Musk is kind of a P.T. Barnum a little bit. He's a bit of a con man. He doesn't really impress me at all in terms of his thinking. I think he might be a good, a good coder and understand how technology works. And he's certainly, I don't know if I'd say charismatic. I don't find him. He definitely has something, you know, a little pizzazz that draws people to him. But he's a bit of a P.T. Barnum. And you know, when you listen to his reasoning of Neuralink, I mean, it's literally blackmail. Join us at Neuralink or die at the hands of artificial intelligence. I mean, that's his selling point. And that's a really dangerous proposition if you actually stop for 2 minutes to like close your eyes and think about what he's saying. It's really scary. So I certainly am not going to get implanted with one of Elon Musk's microbes or microtubes. But I think it's part of the overall trajectory of the neoliberal technological train that's kind of driving 21st century history, which is trying to integrate the subject or the individual more and more directly into the rhythm of both the global technological apparatus and the motion of global capitalism. And when you do that to a person, I mean, my God, it is so horrible. It's so wrong. I mean, to do that to a child, I mean, you have to live in a psychopathic society to do that to a little kid. And I think that's what seems to be happening. But, you know, I don't think it's going to happen. I think that there's going to be an event, you know, or some kind of rupture in this process. And I think we're coming straight towards it right now. I mean, I think we're living through very dangerous and scary. And I always say we live in the most exciting and boring time in the history of the human race. In one sense, it's exciting because the whole drama of humanity from cavemen to 21st century globalized subjects is kind of coming to a conclusion. That's the exciting part. The boring part is everyone's just like tweeting and looking at their fucking cell phone. And that's the really, and that's like the boring part. Like we're not seeing this kind of cosmic drama that we're all part of, man. I mean, this is some of the stuff that I have, you know, I think about just in terms of my own Christian faith. That's part of my outlook of the world, but certainly being part of the indigenous Peruvian culture, living in the Amazon and looking at things different. Like, you know, I always say Iquitos is like the very edge of the symbolic order, meaning that, you know, Iquitos is literally one of the two most isolated cities on planet Earth, in the sense that you cannot get there by car. It's completely surrounded by the Amazon. It's plane or boat. So when you're like, you know, in the port of Nanai or in the Belen market in Iquitos, and you look out over the river, I mean, dude, that's it. Like, there's nothing, like, you're in the jungle, like, you're beyond the symbolic domain, like, there's nothing there. So I think for me, like, writing from there and thinking from there, and I'm actually directing a new film down there right now, it totally changes your viewpoint on what it would be like to, you know, I lived in London before, so I know what it's like there, Mike, and I'm from Boston, and, you know, I've traveled a lot in my life, and I've been around, but being in the Amazon, like, that's literally, like, looking back on the other side. And that's just given me a unique perspective of thinking things differently, I guess. I don't know how to say it, but yeah. So something like Neuralink is pretty terrifying. I mean, that would be my ultimate conclusion to that. You know, there's nothing liberating about Neuralink, nothing at all. And I also think like the way he talks about it, like he's so cavalier in the way he talks about it. It's like he literally like laughing on Twitter. It's like, you can join the Matrix. I mean, it's unbelievable. And he gets like, you know, a million likes. It's, I mean, the degradation of humanity is just unbelievable. The open degradation of humanity, of human dignity is really remarkable. Really remarkable. It's a joke. It's like a carnival, a circus, something like that. A digital circus, a digital bread and circus.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think it's not very clear what, you know, what would happen with this thing. I mean, if it speeds or augments thought, will that make people any more intelligent for using it? Because it, you know, it's a very, very, you know, very much sped up stupid thoughts are just going to make people much, much more stupid. You know,
I mean,
who's using it and to what end. So, you know, it might even be that then you get a situation where people who aren't using these chips or don't have these chips implanted are actually at an advantage compared to those that do have the chips.
And you know something, Mike, sorry to interrupt you, but just one more thing. The best neurologist or the best neurobiologist on planet Earth still cannot tell you how consciousness is generated in the brain. I mean, we still have no clue. Literally, like, we have theories, we have developed theories, we have thoughts, we have, you know, lines of thought that are trying to generate a coherent structure of how consciousness is generated in the human nervous system, but we have no idea how that happens. We have no clue how that happens. So for someone like Elon Musk to say that we know how to interface computational logic with neurons firing, I mean, it's insane, actually. It's super dangerous.
It's all showmanship. And basically all he really had was he had one sheep that apparently had been implanted and one that had previously
no it was a pig it was a pig
it was a
and
pig,
I thought that yeah, was like very
a pig that had been implanted yeah
it was supposed to have,
it was supposed to be chipped now, and then didn't he have a pig that he said had been chipped and it was no longer chipped?
But
and
I mean,
it was okay.
Animals,
but there was no evidence that the chip was in there.
Yeah, and you know, I thought that was revealing, using a pig, like, yeah, you can become like this pig. And the second thing is, animals have been being implanted with microchips in their brain for some time now. Like, that's no big deal. I think I read an article in MIT Review, yeah, like, that was like, what he did, we've known about this for 20 years. Like, this guy didn't say anything new at all, you know? So
yeah, but the last major thing he was doing before then was kind of milling around with how can I not remember his name, man? The husband of Kardashian,
Kanye West,
just yeah, before Kanye announced his presidency, it never happened. And it's still not entirely clear what's happening with that, other than he had a series of breakdowns, which is actually sad. And it's sad the way that he's kind of, you know, treated as a circus act
and he should be, you know, to some extent left alone. Although also, you know, he's courting attention himself. But, you know, it doesn't seem that Elon Musk's judgment is very good, you know, that he seems always to be
linked to failed projects. I also think the other thing that's interesting about Musk is like two of his companies, SpaceX and Neuralink. In one sense, he's trying to get humans off planet Earth with SpaceX, bring people to Mars. And in the other sense, he's trying to almost, I don't even know what the word is, like obliterate the human subject on planet Earth by fusing their brain with his techno-capitalist dystopia. So, I mean, this is a very confused human being, I think, because I don't think he knows what he's doing or knows what he really wants. I think that's
he's playing to a desire to get off our heads, out of our heads,
exactly,
off the planet.
That's exactly right, Mike. He's playing to desire to escape. He's playing to the desire to escape from the global situation that we all find ourselves in.
But on that note, you have escaped in the sense that you're not in Peru now, but you're going back to Peru, and you set up this plant-based healing. Would you call it a center or a site where people can go?
Yeah,
and you know, that is a kind of a way of, you know, as I said, you've in a sense escaped, but I kind of say that, you know, as a way of segueing into the fact that you're dealing with plant-based healing, but you have some kind of interest in, I don't know how you would call it, but spirituality, or how would you say?
Yeah, so just a comment on what you just said. I mean, I have escaped. I mean, I do feel like I'm in a way free from all the stuff that's happening in America. But of course, because the COVID situation down in Peru was really bad. I mean, I was down there when it really started. It was pretty scary. And the embassy in Lima encouraged all Americans to leave. So I was on the fence about what to do, but I did end up coming back. So I've been here now for a few months, and flights are reopening in October. So I'll go back immediately as soon as the flights reopen. And so I mean, I write down there, I'm working on a new film. And then I also have a center that it was just about to, it was open, but it was just in the process of opening when this whole thing started, which was a little, you know, sad and frustrating for me. But it's, you know, we're a center that works with what are called plant diets. And it's a small little center. I mean, I would like to build it up as time goes on, because I do own quite a bit of land out there. But right now it's just very small, and, you know, take some clients. And we don't, you know, the main attraction for a ketose is, of course, ayahuasca, which is something that you guys are interested in your concept of the acid left. A ketose is basically ground zero for the global ayahuasca trade. There's a lot of centers down there, a lot of big centers and a lot of good centers that do really good work. So you see a lot of people coming into a ketose these days, you know. Some people coming to heal, some people coming to self-exploration, some people coming to try it and have a, you know, an interesting experience. But I think that, so my center doesn't work with ayahuasca. We do what's called plant diets, which is a system of basically drinking a tincture of a certain plant or tree every day and having a kind of an eliminatory diet, no salt, no sugar, no meat of any kind, and basically fasting for a whole week, like a bowl of soup at night and a bowl of fruit in the morning, while you engage with this certain plant, depending on what you're looking to address. And that process, what it's called, and we call it a dieta, and it's a process of purging and healing and clearing out, I guess you'd say, energies of the body. And it's it's totally compatible with any type of perspective you have in the world, whether you're whether you're Islamic or whether you're a secular atheist or whether you're, there's no theological contour of it. It's just a healing modality that is part and parcel to elements of shamanism in the upper Peruvian Amazon.
Sure. But I mean, how would this relate, would you say, to what you're talking about, you're dealing with in your work, often critiques of capitalism, critiques of technology gone awry, shall we say?
Well, that's, I guess it relates is because these, and it's not just capitalism and technology. I mean, any system can hurt people. But I guess the point that I think of, I guess like maybe 10 years ago, I would have said, you have to psychologically or spiritually heal the world for things to get better. And then maybe 5 years ago, I would have said, you need to materially address the problems of, you know, corporations or whatever to change the political landscape of the world. And now I'm kind of back to, you really, like a society of sick people, a society, like a sick culture is going to make sick solutions. So, I mean, for me, I think what's, and this is something, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Franco Baratti, Bifo Baratti, but his last couple books, like Breathing, The Second Coming, they're really great. And he talks a lot about the need for the left, especially because he's a figure of the far left, to integrate some kind of therapeutic process into their politics. And I think that healing has to be front and center right now, healing. And I think that if, you know, people are, you know, you look at what's happening in America right now with, you know, these protests between the right and the left, and the common denominator is the anger. And the, and this isn't to say like being, there's not, I'm not saying like people are angry and people should be angry. There's a lot of things going on in the world right now that are not very good, but there's no like, there's no, I don't notice like spiritual wisdom, or there's no like detachment. There's no desire to really heal, I guess, the situation. So I think in my own little way, this center is to, if I can help people, I will, and then continue with my work. And I mean, I'm committed to living down there, and I have my life down there, and I want to keep writing books and directing films and have this little center as well. And that, but I do think that any political program that wants to address the unbelievable injustices that are happening across this world right now, there some kind of healing or therapeutical process has to be integrated into the consciousness of the social or political ideology, without question. And I think a lot of old political ideologies don't really have, like if you look at America, no one really talks about healing. Like Joe Biden has said it, but he said it in like a very abstract kind of goofy way. Like we have to come together and heal. Okay, yeah, of course we do. But the language has to be more specific. We have to talk about trauma. We have to talk about the pain that people are in. And we have to really talk about the pain that people are in from the isolation and overcompetition of our society. And I think by doing that and introducing therapeutic models to deal with that, and really like new, like one of the reasons why I'm set up the center is because plant dieting helped me so much in my own life, man. I mean, it really helped me. I mean, and then ayahuasca, I've drank ayahuasca, I don't even know, many hundreds of times, and it's really helped me. And a lot of the traditional therapeutic model, I mean, like something like cognitive behavioral therapy in America, I mean, that's like the neoliberal dream of therapy, because it just like addressing symptoms, like what can you do to feel better? You know what I mean? So I'm definitely interested of like non-traditional therapies, but not like weird, like new age type of stuff. Like I want to have common sense and you know, I was in a cult when I was in my late 20s. So, I mean, I don't want to do that at all again. I want to have my 2 feet on the ground, think clearly, be rationally, but I don't want to be forced into this like technological science approved, you know, science says this will heal you. You know, I want to live from my experience and try things and, but also be responsible and be rational and be informed and be educated about what I'm doing. So that's kind of my philosophy on healing, I guess.
Wonderful.
I do think that the, you know, one of the writers that I'm very interested in, he hasn't written a whole lot. He's only written 4 books, but Terrence McKenna, he's written extensively on stuff that you guys are talking about, the acid left and the potential of psychedelics to really change conditions on planet Earth, on spaceship Earth. And even though he's crazy. I mean, he's great, but he's crazy. But there's a lot of things he says that are right on. And I think being down there in Iquitos is a place where he frequented quite a bit when he was alive. And it's cool being down there, man. It's like every day is an adventure. I mean, you go out in the boat, and I went freight hopping one time for a couple of weeks and just kind of hopped on. Iquitos is like a port city, so there's all these freights coming in and out all the time carrying cargo. And you can kind of jump on, and like there, you can set up hammocks on the top just for like, you know, regular passengers, just, you know, indigenous people that don't have money for a flight that need to go somewhere. And I remember being out, I went out there one time for about, I don't even know, maybe 10 days, 2 weeks. And it was just the most, it was really a life-changing experience to be out in the middle of the Amazon jungle, you know, sleeping on a hammock and just being away from the world, like no technology, no nothing, in the middle of all places, the Amazon jungle, which is the lungs of planet Earth. And I think, you know, people like McKenna have had that experience too. And their writing, their writing is informed by that experience. So I think I definitely want both, as I continue to write, I want the experience of not only the Amazon jungle and the importance of the ecology of the Amazon, but also the people of Iquitos and their stories and just the day-to-day life of a city that, in my opinion, is still very human. I always tell my friends when I'm like, what's it like to live in Iquitos? And I'm like, I don't know. It's probably like living in like the Lower East Side in the 1920s or something like that. It's probably like living in the North End of Boston in the 1950s, in the sense that you walk outside and there's like kids playing soccer in the street, and there's old ladies sitting outside in front of their house, and, you know, old men playing cards and smoking. It's like the street life there is so vibrant. Like every night you walk out, there's just all this stuff happening. And it's a, you know, it's a half million people. And it's like, you come back, I'm from Boston, and you come back and you like walk through Boston. It's like, oh my God. It's like, you come back, it's like, you guys don't know what you're missing. I mean, it's like to live in a city, like a place like Iquitos, it's like you walk outside on the Monday night, it's like fun. It's like people are talking and it's just like a carnival. And you come back to like these hyper gentrified American cities, and it's like walking through a museum. There's no life, there's no street life, there's no street culture. And so I think that's one of the other things that's for me has been just like, when you live in a neighborhood where you can like go outside and talk to your neighbors and like smoke a cigarette and shoot the shit and play cards, I mean, that's fun. I mean, that's very therapeutic in and of itself, you know?
Yeah, that's a beautiful description of a city. I definitely want to experience that. I think I've experienced it in smaller doses. And what you said about the left needing to kind of incorporate some of that healing and address that trauma, I think that's why in the U.S. you saw a surge of figures like, what's her name, Marianne Williamson? Even though she's a lot of flaws, but there was a genuine draw to her for those reasons.
She was, in my opinion, she was dismissed by the left so prematurely. And I don't even think people were listening. They just thought like California, new age, crazy lady, don't listen to her. Meanwhile, for me, she, on the Democratic debate stage, she was the clearest, most rational, most coherent voice of everybody without question. Now, I'm not saying she should have been president, and I didn't really look at her policy positions too closely, but when she was speaking, I was like, yep, I agree with that. Yep, that's basic common sense. Yep, that sounds like an honest person talking, you know? So
yeah, I thought she performed great. Amazingly.
Yeah.
I think she has some questionable stuff in her past that we don't have time to get into. But
sure.
Okay, I think we're kind of running out of time. It's been really great and a really good demonstration of how all these different things intersect. So we hope you have a great time. It sounds you will have a great time anyway, but we wish you well returning to Peru, and we hope you'll be able to join us some point in the coming months to kind of update us on how things are going there.
I want to thank you guys for having me on. I appreciate the invite, and I think what you guys are doing is really cool, really interesting. I've been telling Adam on our Facebook conversations that it's just the whole, just your interviews and your thoughts are super important. And I just feel, thank you for having me on. I guess that's all I want to say.